What is up, my stay-at-home sports fans? Welcome to Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fan. I am King Kaz. I am joined, as I always am, by my good friend and co-host, the one, the great JVZ. JVZ, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. we're getting used to this. It's not so bad. We're getting a lot of sports news, at least enough to do a show like every other week. So
we're still here. We're still kicking. We've done some special episodes. We did some favorite esports things, which now that I think about it, I think we have to do one more. We may have to go back and do one for DJM and fighting games, but we'll talk about that. You did League of Legends. I talked about Counter-Strike. So if you have not heard those should be going up on the feeds pretty soon, so you can check those out. And I've been watching a lot of catching up on some esports tournament stuff, which we will be talking about later. We'll be talking about some of the League of Legends things that are going on. But to start the show off, we're going to do our roundup. And this one harkens back to us talking about the Astros and their cheating scandal that has kind of unfolded over the last 2 years or so about all the things that they did and all that stuff. And where we thought we were at the height of that, somehow, some way, we've taken a pivot. And now it has come out that the Red Sox were also caught cheating as well.
Yeah, so that was kind of one of the wait and see items. There was kind of a pending investigation for the Red Sox. And then also the Red Sox got caught a couple years ago, and they were just fined for using an Apple Watch to try to relay signs to the dugout. So that initial act, that initial fine was supposed to be like, okay, it's not specifically written in the rules that this is not allowed, but we want to take this electronic sign stealing very seriously. So anybody who does this from now on is going to get hefty penalties. So that's why the Astros penalty was heavier than just a fine. Although I think a lot of people would agree that it wasn't enough of a penalty, especially towards the players. But the Red Sox getting caught a couple years ago was initially what started this increased scrutiny around sign stealing, and then the Astros got exposed. And then that became a big old thing. So now the Red Sox were investigated again, and they were caught again. This time, they're forfeiting a 2020 second round pick. The video operator JT Watkins has been suspended through the 2021 postseason, and manager Alex Cora, who was kind of kicked out as part of the Astros scandal, and let go from the Red Sox, has now been suspended through the end of the 2020 postseason.
I think there was something you said when we kind of initially talked about this, when we were talking about it for the Astros, right? This is one of those things, as far as sign stealing goes, everyone does it, right?
It's allowed for... like if you're just doing it manually, if you have a guy on second base and he wants to relay signs to the dugout, then that's kind of in a way expected. And because it's expected, it's not necessarily frowned upon. You see a guy on second base, you know that there's a potential that that guy can see the catcher's signs. What's not allowed is the doing it electronically or using the cameras on the field to help you with that, and so that's not allowed, because at that point you're just really predicting pitches, and at that point you can kind of just hit everything out of the park, just like the Astros did that 1 year. So
yeah, because that that's kind of the big thing of it for maybe those who are a little slow on the baseball uptake. The signs are what comes from the catcher to the pitcher to kind of discuss what pitch they should throw next and essentially where they should throw it too. But now as these fines kind of go and go along and kind of come out, I'm starting to look at some of these suspensions and things like that, and I'm looking at this Alex Cora suspension through the 2020 postseason, where physically where we are at in the world, does a suspension for anything happening in the 2020 season even matter?
Nope. And also, like, he has already kicked off the team, so, like, whatever. Like, it's almost like, hey, you got it's like getting suspended from your job that you already got fired from. And so, like, that's, like, it's kind of pointless. In a way, it just means, like, okay, he can't get hired by another team and then coach them, you know, into the 2020 postseason. That's basically it. Basically for this case, JT Watkins, the video operator, they basically just kind of blamed him for everything.
Thrown under the bus.
Yeah, they threw him under the bus here because what he reportedly did was just he's the video operator, so he's watching the video during the game. What he was doing was decoding signs and then including them in, like, the real time scouting reports that the players use and look at. So I guess the way they're trying to frame this is that he was kind of doing this on his own. And even though some players knew he was doing this, but, like, nobody, they're trying to make it seem like nobody asked him to do this, which I don't believe at all. Especially when you consider Alex Cora's connections to the Astros and where a lot of this kind of originated, and the Red Sox history of getting caught in these scandals. So it's, I mean, to me, like, all these suspensions kind of seem weak sauce, especially this, since this is the second time the Red Sox were caught. Just to kind of put it in perspective, the Astros lost 2 first-round picks and 2 second-round picks and a $5 million fine, which is the maximum allowed. But the Red Sox kind of just get 1 second-round pick forfeited, and that's pretty much it. And they got to blame it all on the video guy. I don't know. I mean, it seems pretty weak to me. And
yeah,
it seems like I can't believe I'm, like, falling back on the NCAA for this, but they have a punishment for lack of institutional control. And that's what they use as, like, the catch-all to blame anybody whenever, like, to punish the organization when something bad happens.
Yeah. As weird as it is to give any kind of praise or credit to the NCAA, I do think more professional leagues do need those kind of blanket terminologies for blame and punishment.
Yeah. I mean, they're ripe for abuse, but I feel like in a situation like this where, you can say, like, oh, nobody higher up knew this was happening, but in a way that's kind of an indictment on them that they didn't know about it. They've lost control of this, and this happened under their watch, and, you know, maybe they didn't adequately communicate, you know, the rules to, I mean, they claim that they adequately communicated all the rules to everybody, and everybody was told that they shouldn't do this, but this guy did it anyways. But
yeah,
in a way, this still happened anyways. It still happened under your watch.
So one of the things I think I think going into the future is going to be just kind of a which team is next more than anything else, because I really don't think this is going to just stop at the Astros and the Red Sox. Right. This is I think this is going to be a boulder that continues to roll downhill, and we're just going to kind of hear more and more teams. And then I think in kind of some future situation, I think that is then what happens is I think the MLB will have to then come to some kind of new rule thing where they start to add blanket terms like that for these kind of things, and find ways to actually make these punishments hit in a way, because you're like, the big thing, and one of the things we always talk about on the show, is kind of losing control of the situation, especially to the media. So if the media starts to spin this as the heads of Major League Baseball can't control baseball, you know, that's bad press, and nobody ever wants that.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of the criticism around the way Major League Baseball has handled this, and with the weak ass penalties that they've given out, and because I think there's like the fear that a lot of teams are doing this. So then if you come down hard on the Astros, you're going to have to come down hard on everybody. But also, I think there's a lot of fans that are like, yeah, do that, and like you need to get the stuff out of the game, because like this affects how people perceive the integrity of the game is. Like if you have something like a gambling scandal or you know, or a match fixing scandal or anything like that, that makes people think that these games are fixed, or that certain teams are given an advantage over other teams, or people are cheating, or people are injecting themselves with performance enhancing drugs or whatever. It's like, you know, at that point, then people have to ask, like, you know, how clean is this game? Like, what am I actually watching on TV here? Am I watching one team have, am I going into this game knowing that both these teams have a possibility of winning, or is this just a foregone conclusion because this is rigged to one side? And if it's just a foregone conclusion, then why bother watching?
All right. So moving on from there, we're going to talk about a little bit of what's going on with the NHL and where they are in their state of the COVID-19 shutdown. So right now, according to this hockeyfeed.com article, the NHL is trying to poise for a return around June.
Yeah, and that's just for when players are going to come back from camp. So they've effectively told everybody that's the date that you're coming back. So this last month before then, this is the rest of your treat this like a vacation, and then report back on June 1st. Mm-hmm. So they haven't actually figured out how they're going to actually play these games yet, but okay. I think they're discussing the possibility of using just a couple stadiums as places to hold most of the games. So that'll get around the fact that that you know, not every city in the United States and Canada is you know, open for business yet. So you know, as DGM says, the rest of the arenas are being kept on ice. I think Edmonton is one of those locations. Arizona is another one of those locations. For some reason, Arizona just pops up as a location for every sport as like a place you can start mm-hmm. playing again. And I don't know what that says about Arizona or their coronavirus restrictions, those are a couple of the sites that have been brought up. So we might learn a little bit more in the next couple weeks about what their plan actually is. And if they do end up being the first kind of physical sport out of the gate, then other sports can kind of use that as a blueprint for how to come back, basically. And I think it would be pretty good for hockey to be the first sport, since not a whole lot of people watch hockey, but everybody who watches hockey seems to enjoy it. So I think people with not a whole lot of other stuff to watch will tune in droves just to watch any sport. And
Well, speaking of sports people have been watching, we have kind of mostly wrapped up the League of Legends season. So Cloud9 won the LCS, G2 won the, I forget what the EU version is
LEC.
Called.
LEC.
And then T1 won the LCK. So they've all won their respective spring splits. C9 has won more awards than I think anybody could ever imagine.
Swept everything. They won all five of their players got in the all LCS first team. Their coach won coach of the year. Their jungler, who's this is his first season as like a full time starter, won the MVP. Yeah, and then they went 26-2 the entire split, and that includes playoff matches, which are best of fives.
So
they lost one match in the regular season, one match during the entire playoff run, and then beat FlyQuest in the finals 3-0. And then so this is their first split since 2014, which split happened to be a very dominant one as well. So it seems like in years where they kind of kicked the shit out of everybody, they win titles, and every other split, they're just not doing so hot, or they throw it at the last second, or this has been a long time coming. I think you and I have kind of followed this team for quite a while now, so it's good to see. I think this is the first time that they finally got rid of everybody from that original roster that did win everything, and so after finally letting go of everybody, they finally powered up to become not just a top team in the league, but like an extremely dominant one. They look like they kind of belong in their own region.
You know what's kind of weird? The year they won the major in Counter-Strike was also right after they kind of got rid of the last... Well, some of the last pieces of their old guard, kind of. Yeah. So that was when Shroud and Nothing both happened to leave the Counter-Strike team, and they picked up two other players, and they kind of had the pieces of people they replaced from that original kind of dominant team that Shroud and Nothing had formed. And then they went on to win the major that year. So in pretty dominant fashion too. So that's just like kind of a weird thing with Cloud9, that like they have these teams that are kind of dominant, and they tend to hold on to pieces or players for a really long time. Even though now the Counter-Strike team has been kind of a checkers board of people moving around. So it's been pretty weird over there.
Yeah. So, yeah, congratulations to them. Also, one other fun fact, Sven, their AD carry, is now the first player to win the European title and the North American title. I can't believe he's the only person that has ever done that, but apparently he is. And he's also a very tall player, and while holding up the trophy, he managed to break it by smacking it up against the ceiling. So so we're either going to need a repaired or new LCS trophy. The Chinese League, which is the other major region, their finals, I think, are going to be this weekend between Top Esports and JD Gaming, who beat Fun Plus Phoenix, the defending world champions. So unfortunately, we are not going to have a midseason invitational tournament, so we won't see these four teams go up against each other in the midseason.
We talked about how much easier it is to do esports because of the online factor. It also makes it extremely harder when you try to run a world event.
Yeah, especially in a game where ping times are so important. It's you can't really. I mean, you can try to hold a world event, but it's
somebody's gonna have a massive advantage.
And so, so naturally, it was canceled. On top of that, just the travel, it's. I mean, I'm sure nobody's actually playing on Wi-Fi, but still, it's much easier to. Like, I think everybody in the LCS lives and plays in Los Angeles. So it's one thing where everybody's in the same city versus everybody scattered around the world. So it's I'm sure they maybe they can do like some sort of exhibition thing, but somebody's also going to have to wake up really early for that. So that's another disadvantage. All right. So one quick bit of NFL news. I know we've been following Jameis Winston and his saga from his 30 for 30, 30, his 50 touchdown, 30 interception season. And then fixing his blindness, all of that. And now he's no longer a Tampa Bay Buccaneer. Tom Brady is now the starting quarterback for them. Jameis Winston needs a team, and it looks like he's going to sign a one-year deal with the Saints. So that is to be their backup quarterback behind Drew Brees. One fun fact about this is that Jameis Winston has thrown more passes to New Orleans Saints players than current backup or the existing Saints backup, Taysom Hill. So, but that's just because Jameis Winston throws a lot of interceptions. Mm-hmm. The NBA is, Taysom Hill actually just signed a 2-year deal as well. So I think they're still, for some reason, a believer in Taysom Hill, whether as a quarterback or just somebody that they can, just as an athletic player that they can put on the field at the same time as their whoever their quarterback is. But Winston's deal is just for 1 year. And then I think he'll test the free agency market next year again after a year of learning from Sean Payton and Drew Brees.
Okay.
But yeah, I hope he gets a chance. I hope we get a chance to see non-blind Jameis at some point this season and see how much it helped.
Yeah. I definitely always kind of think, especially in sports, you kind of have to give people second and third chances.
Yes.
Because sometimes certain teams are just not the right fit for people. Yeah. And then sometimes certain environments, certain coaches, there's a lot that goes into it, right? There's a lot that has to gel and a lot that has to, like, GGM says, like, best example, Ryan Tannehill. Like, sometimes you're in a situation and it can just make you look bad just because you just don't necessarily gel in that environment.
Actually, Drew Brees is probably the best example of that. And like, yeah. We think of him as a legend now in for the Saints, but there was a time where like he was the San Diego Chargers starting quarterback and they ran him out of town. And they did get a long-term replacement, Philip Rivers, as his backup at the time, and who ended up being their long-term solution. So it wasn't that bad of a decision. But we didn't think of Drew Brees as good of a quarterback as we think of him now. And it took a change of scenery for him to get to that point. And it seemed like the change was immediate too. So it's, and this was after like a really bad shoulder surgery too. So, so you never know, like you can go from one team to another and you can be trash somewhere and be treasure somewhere else. Ryan Tannehill is a good example of that. And he just got a massive contract, this year because of how well he performed, even for just half a season this year for Tennessee. So, who knows what'll happen with Jameis Winston.
All right. So let's go from there and talk about the NBA. So the NBA right now is, I guess they're telling teams that they can start workouts in May 1st, but that is state by state dependent. So essentially they're saying if your state will allow it, the NBA would like you to start working out your team on May 1st or
I think it's
in
May
the start 8th. Of May. Yeah. May 8th. Yeah.
Which is kind of weird.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, it's especially doing it like the state by state thing, because I feel like that gives some teams certain advantages. Mm-hmm. Like if your state happens to be depending on your viewpoint, if they're lenient, or I would say if your governor is an absolute doofus, like some of these governors that are out there that are just kind of rushing to get to reopen business. I mean, not just from a safety standpoint, but from an imbalance standpoint. Like, I think California, and I imagine part of this is biased because I think Sacramento is probably going to be one of the last places to open up, because California is kind of one of the more cautious states with this. Despite the fact that it looks like we're kind of on the path to recovery here, it's going to be weird to give some teams that advantage and other teams not that advantage. But I think the initial plan is for May 8th, but they may push that date back. So I think we'll find out as we get closer. So it's not set in stone yet. And maybe, like we said, the NHL kind of has a plan for how they want to do this. And so maybe other leagues will take, we'll watch them and see if they fuck up first and then learn from it. But, one team that did fuck up is the Los Angeles Lakers, who got a $4.6 million loan from the Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program.
Oh, goodness. So
if you've been hearing about the news of big companies applying for these small business loans and getting them granted, one of them happens to be the LA Lakers. They claimed that as soon as they found out that the program had run out of money, they returned the $4.6 million so other small businesses could get a chance to get some of that money. But I don't know what made them think that they were a small business in the first place, considering they're one of the richest teams in the NBA, considering they're an NBA team, period, and the NBA is wildly profitable. The Lakers, I think, are valued at somewhere around $4 billion. So you're not a small business. I kind of think that like some of these companies that are getting trashed for doing this kind of just applied just to see if they could get it, and then once it was publicized that like, oh, they got it and they shouldn't have, then now everybody's realizing, oh, this is bad PR. And Genie
Bus was the system.
Yeah, like I'm a hustle somebody. And it's no, this is like there are a lot more businesses out there that are struggling. And compare it to a team like the Mavericks that's trying to help the local businesses around them by saying that like anybody that works for us that wants to support local businesses will reimburse you for that, and also like keeping people paid, which the Lakers have said that they are doing. So that's nice, but they didn't need a $4.6 million loan from the government to do that. So thankfully they came to their senses on that, even if it took a PR disaster to do that. But that's a little weird. In more encouraging NBA news, specifically regarding the G League, number one high school recruit guard Jalen Green has committed to the G League, which actually kind of caught a lot of people off guard. I don't think he's like the first person to do this. We talked about Darius Bazley doing this a couple years ago, choosing to go to the G League instead of college, and then he ended up backing out of that and doing just a private, just working out privately for a year. And then I think he was eventually drafted by the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, LaMelo Ball and RJ Hampton committed to playing in the Australian League, and they've got a professional program that is designed for kind of for the one and done situation, where these athletes can actually still get paid for this and work with agents and all of that. And the only catch to that is you got to go play in Australia, which isn't quite so bad as playing in in other places, especially since they speak English and the Australian basketball scene is actually improving a lot. So, I mean, LaMelo Ball now is a contender for the number one overall pick. So, DJMS, is the one and done rule being axed by the NBA? And the answer to that is they're talking about it. But I don't think they've actually agreed on that yet. And so that has to be an agreement in between the NBA and the players union. And I don't think they've actually come to an agreement on that, even though they've been talking about it. And they've signaled their intention to try to get rid of the rule, but it just hasn't been priority at this point. So I guess if that change does not happen, then this G League system, this new program that they're coming up with, is a nice backup. The reason why Jalen Green, the story isn't just that he committed, that one of the top high school recruits chose to go to the G League. The story here is why, and part of why is this new professional path program that the G League is coming up with. And first of all, Jalen Green is going to be paid $500,000 for this 1 year. So that's significantly more than a college scholarship. Significantly more than what he'd be paid to go play in Australia. Maybe not significantly, but it's more than what he would have been paid to have to go overseas. He can stay home. I mean, he actually grew up in Fresno, so this new program is going to take place in Southern California, so that's going to be pretty close to where he's played. He's going to be joined by another recruit, forward Isaiah Todd, and there's a bunch of other recruits that are also considering this as well. I don't know if they're going to be paid as much as Jalen Green is getting paid, but that all these salaries are kind of in the six-figure range. So that's a pretty hefty chunk of change to play professionally. And on top of that, they're going to fill out this team with all of these recruits and a couple other veterans that they're going to specifically select to kind of mentor these players. So this is a program designed entirely to help these guys transition into the NBA a year from now. To put it cynically, it's like they're coddling them to make sure that they're okay and to make sure that they're NBA ready. But also, it's, you know, to say it non-cynically, they're supporting these players. They're not just kind of throwing them in the deep end and saying, hey, you guys go out and play with all these, you know, 25, 26, 27 year old hungry G League guys that are going to beat you up. And, you know, because these kids are 18 still. And so their bodies are still developing, and throwing one advantage of putting them in college is that they're playing with other players that are in the 18 to 22 age range. And, but you know, now you throw these guys out there with adults and they can get banged around, they can get hurt, they can get, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff could happen. On top of that, they got to move. They got to adjust to the rigorous G League traveling schedule. And this select team that they're putting together is only going to play 10 to 12 exhibition games instead against those G League teams. But also they're going to play some international games against some of the academy teams worldwide and some other foreign national clubs. But, so they're going to get some pretty good experience here.
Yeah. And you talk about them getting hurt and that kind of stuff, but I think, and we've discussed this before, I think it's a better thing, especially if you don't need the extra development time that college could possibly give you, right? If you're pretty close to NBA ready and you can put yourself in a position to earn the money, to maybe even if you have the hype around you, get the endorsement deals already set in place, that could put you in a position to maybe make the, you know, that transition faster. Because like we talked about, a lot of these guys' careers are shelf-lifed anyway, right? A lot of these guys' careers are going to go down the line of going down the route of possibly getting injured, possibly being done before they even get there, right? A lot of guys' college careers end their career. So it's just one of those things where I just like this as an option, right? I love the fact that guys can say, you know what, I feel like, and with the amount of scouting I have and all the stuff that's been going on and everybody already telling me that I'm possibly NBA ready, I'd rather take the route of going through the G League than having to go to school for 2 years, 3 years, whatever, before I can make that chance. And not have any real development time, be just thrown into the deep end. Because, like we said, sometimes even with the college career, you're playing against, you're still not playing at the NBA level, you know. So this is putting you closer to that level. This is putting you closer to an opportunity to see that you could have that.
DJM asks if this team has a name yet, and it doesn't. I think they're still working out the details for how to do this, but I think, you know, now that they've got like a top recruit, so like Jalen Green,
they're pretty much throwing these guys together to try and make like a almost super team.
Yeah, like a G League super team. Like I don't know whether they'll necessarily be super, because these guys are still kind of straight out of high school and going up against professional players. But okay.
JVZ,
this.
Everything else aside about the players and all of us here are relatively pro player.
Yeah.
I'm just going to be fully cynical here on
okay.
for the sake of the NBA and the G League. And I'm seeing marketing here. That's what this looks like. Like if these guys are declaring that they want to go to the G League. If I'm not mistaken, doesn't the G League have a draft? Doesn't the G League have some sort of free agency where guys would sign to G League teams? I'm wondering why those aren't being implemented for these players.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a path that they could use before. But yeah, I mean, I agree. This actually is just marketing. And I think part of it is to try to make the G League a more popular league. So both market the G League, but also market the G League to potential recruits. It's because Isaiah Todd actually had committed to Michigan, I think. And then at some point, I think when the Jalen Green news broke, or I think when the G League called him with this offer, I think it was just an enticing enough offer that he decided to decommit and play for this G League Select team instead. So I think, yeah, I mean, they're just trying to make this a really attractive option to top high school recruits. And I don't want to say that this is like a shot across the bow to college basketball, but and it's more of a, it's more of a shot at the one and done system, which everybody agreed was bad to begin with. So, it's like they're not there to play school, as I think Cardale Jones famously said. If you're there to go to school, then yeah, go the college basketball route. If you're, you know, and then, you know, use your athletic ability to help you get an education. If your eventual goal is the NBA, then that does not require the NCAA to stand in between there. You don't have to play, you know, you don't have to play several years in college against college level players to prove that you are ready to play in the NBA. You can do that against the level below the NBA, which is the G League, and prove that you belong there first. This is definitely a nice option for those players, and they are selling the G League and trying to make it look more attractive and going out of their way to do it. But I think I think it's worth it if you can get these kind of recruits. And I think it'll get more eyes on the G League in general as well, which broadcasts games on Twitch. So, you know, now if you want to watch Jalen Green play, you can just go to Twitch and watch the G League next year.
All right. So going on from there, I think this is kind of our big story of the week. This is something we've been talking about the lead up to, but it is the Bulls documentary, or the Jordan-led documentary, called The Last Dance. We've gotten episodes 1, 2, 3, and 4 so far. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So ESPN has been showing this. I have not taken a chance to watch this yet, but I know you guys have. And I've been seeing all of Twitter going crazy about this, especially Scottie Pippen, who I, even in that time, because I was not allowed to like the Bulls then, because I was a diehard Knicks fan as a kid. This has kind of been catching the internet by storm, and I'm was going to kind of wait for this to all be out, but I'm starting to feel like maybe I should just be watching this with everybody else.
Yeah. So, I mean, Cass, you can now, or go ahead.
Yes, you should. And JVZ, okay. I'll let you go. And so far, real quick, and then I'll let JVZ go. You could make a real case that for this documentary, Scottie Pippen is the hero of the story.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of that, like all the Scottie Pippen memes, and then people talking about, man, Scottie's the guy. Like,
all right, go ahead, JB.
Yeah. First of all, if you want to watch it, you cannot do that on ESPN Plus, which I found out the hard way. You still need a cable subscription. So fuck that. All the episodes except for the last two have leaked, so you can find other ways if you're well versed in how to do that to watch these episodes. But the first four are officially released. Episodes 1 and 2 are kind of focused on the way they've kind of framed this is actually really interesting, because the entire documentary, it's called The Last Dance because that was kind of the nickname for the final season. They knew it would be their final season together. And the documentary kind of goes into why, but this will be the 1997-98 season that resulted in the Bulls' final championship of their run. Spoilers. There's a film crew following them around all year. So that's what the documentary is centered around, but they also want to provide some historical context as well. So the first episode, or the episodes 1 and 2, are like the beginning of that 1997-98 season, but also a bunch of historical context that supports that. So this is the start of the season where everybody knew that this would be their final season. So why is it their final season? Well, because of Jerry Krause, their general manager, said so. So then it goes into the history of Jerry Krause, how he got to be a part of the team, how he was a former, how he worked for the Chicago White Sox baseball team. And then Jerry Reinsdorf, who also owns both the White Sox and the Bulls, brought him over to the Bulls side. It talks about young Michael Jordan and young Scottie Pippen, and before, back when they were in high school and growing up, and then how they eventually became Bulls players. And in the case of Jordan, got drafted. In the case of Pippen, was drafted and then traded to the Bulls. So that was episode 1 and 2. And then episodes 3 and 4, they kind of talk about the midseason period where Dennis Rodman went, he basically took a vacation in the middle of the season, which, like, is on its own is just really weird. But he took a vacation to Vegas, married Carmen Electra, and did all this stuff. He was supposed to only be gone for 2 days, but then was gone for like 7. And then Michael and Scottie had to go drag him out of his hotel room and bring him back to the team. That on its own was weird as shit. But then who is Dennis Rodman? So then they go into a history of Dennis Rodman. They go into the history of Dennis Rodman specifically as part of the Detroit Pistons, who was the first major team that the Bulls had to overcome in order to reach greatness. And so like that, there are a lot of nice parallels there. And then who, you know, and then this guy eventually ends up on the Bulls. And then so there's, yeah, so that period of like the late 80s with Rodman on the Pistons and Phil Jackson becoming coach of the Bulls and kind of elevating this team to the next level after, you know, after, you know, getting this team to play together instead of just hand the ball to Michael and get out of the way. So, yeah, I haven't seen the next episodes coming up. But it'll be interesting. Like I'm assuming that there, as far as the 97-98 season goes, it'll be kind of the next step chronologically, and then more historical context to support.
JVZ, I do believe that some of the next episodes will focus on actually Steve Kerr.
Oh, okay. Yeah, who is now coach of the Golden State Warriors, mm-hmm. and. Yeah, who was, I think, very famously got into a fight with Jordan in practice. And I think, yeah, a lot of this docuseries is going to focus on just how much of an asshole Michael Jordan was. I think he's come out and said that this is not going to make him look good, even though it kind of has made him look good, because in a way it's kind of emphasized just how much of a competitor he is, but also just also the negative aspects of that competitiveness and how he treated his teammates. And, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of footage of him bullying his teammates on the 97-98 Bulls. Scott Burrell has taken the brunt of it so far. Yeah, I know there's a lot of footage, a lot of talk about how mean Jordan and Pippen were towards Jerry Krause, who gets a lot of the blame for dismantling this dynasty that he also gets a lot of credit for building. So so it's a pretty interesting documentary into, I think, a lot of us were kids, you know, or like, yeah, like if you're a quote-unquote millennial, you were this was the dominant basketball team of your childhood. And yeah. So it's really nice to go back and look through all this. I think a lot of the Scottie Pippen stuff you were talking about, Kaz, was centered around like how bad Scottie Pippen's contract was for him. I think he signed like a 10-year contract, and he was being paid like $1 or $2 million a year, while I think, you know, Jordan was getting paid like 30 in his last couple of years. And
yeah,
so and Pippen eventually ended up getting pretty massive contracts after that, and he actually ended up making more money in his entire career than Jordan did. But also Jordan also took a couple years off several times. So, yeah, this is it's just a really interesting look back at that part of a lot of our childhoods and a lot of the stuff that we didn't see. For me, it's been interesting so far to see all the stuff that happened before I started watching basketball in, you know, in 1995, I think. So it's so yeah, I didn't see the first threepeat.
Okay, because I did. Of course,
I was very aware of it. I knew it was a thing. I was you know, obviously like kind of, I was a fly by night basketball fan even then, but then like I think kind of 94-95 is where I kind of really got into basketball, especially like the Patrick Ewing era, and stuff like that. Like
it was actually Michael Jordan's return that actually got me, because like I remember those headlines more than anything else of like, oh, Michael Jordan.
I just want to say that I think that for the fly-by-night sports fan, how I've said this to some people, one is that this is a great epilogue to Space Jam, which of course documented the real events after Michael Jordan left the Chicago Bulls the first time to play baseball, and definitely not for gambling. For me, I guess I have a much deeper connection with a lot of this because, of course, I'm a Pistons fan, And the Bad Boys were a part of my very early childhood. And my older sister, a lot of people around here, they're not watching this documentary out of protest. Because as you would have seen still in this documentary, that hatred that Michael Jordan had for the Detroit Pistons for how they physically mauled him is still there. He still does not like the Bad Boy Pistons. Isaiah Thomas, John Sally, they're all kind of, he's cool. Michael Jordan, he's the greatest ever. They're all pretty much cool with it. But Jordan, he still hates them. And that was hilarious.
One of the actually interesting things that they did, because they've interviewed different people over the course of this, and I think they interviewed Jordan most recently for this, but like one of the things they've done with this, I think knowing how notoriously petty Jordan is they took clips from other people's interviews and they showed those clips to Jordan,
including
and had
Isaiah's,
him react to them.
Including, before
they even get a chance to show him Isaiah Thomas's clip, Jordan just trashes him, and then he watches the clip and he's like, yep, I was right. And also,
if you noticed in the room that there were a couple of cigars and a couple of glasses of whiskey at the table while Jordan was being interviewed. So he was feeling like he could say whatever he wanted during this documentary.
And he's never shied away from being petty. Like, this is a guy who basically spent his entire Hall of Fame speech,
especially towards the Pistons.
Yeah. And so you two both come from fan bases that are not allowed to enjoy the Bulls effectively. And so for me, it was like, being a fan of the Sacramento Kings, them being the local team, you were kind of, because they were so trash and still are, you in a way, as a kid, you're kind of allowed to have a second team. So
I totally relate.
Yeah. And then so on top of that, on top of that, like they were on NBC like all the time. So they were always
on national
TV.
I was actually able to get WGN here. So I would actually be able to see Chicago Bulls pretty often. If they weren't playing the Pistons, I could see pretty much all of their games when I wanted to. I think just because of my generation, even though being from Detroit, we all, and Isaiah Thomas said this himself, we all eventually grew a respect for Michael Jordan, except for Bill Laimbeer. But then again, nobody likes Bill Laimbeer.
I think it's kind of the same growing up in New York.
You had the Patrick Ewing / John Starks years, right?
Which is weird because, like, 9 times out of 10, most people are going to be a Ewing fan. I was a Starks guy. It's just one of those things. Like, I think for me, right, I fell in love with that team because that was a team that really fucking fought for it, right? And I don't think I've ever seen a Knicks team try that hard since.
You're right about that.
And I think that's what it was, right? It was always kind of, as hard as we tried, there was just this bigger opposition ahead of us that, like, just we couldn't get over.
That's pretty similar to the Pistons this idea, especially during the 80s, because it was the Boston Celtics, Larry Bird, Robert Parrish, Kevin McHale. And it was also the Showtime Lakers with Magic Johnson. And then here comes the Detroit Pistons, the team nobody really wants. It's not L.A. It's not New York. It's not Boston. And they're playing this mean, ugly style of basketball that Michael Jordan wanted to make sure everybody knew was bad for the game of basketball and bad for the NBA, so we had to get rid of the Pistons, get them out of there. And fuck you, we're gonna kill your narrative. And that's what the Pistons did, and that's why I love them, because they broke that up. The rise of Michael Jordan was put on hold because of the Detroit Pistons, and that was really cool. For Pistons fans my age and older, until, as they say in the documentary, after the Jordan rules became a thing with the Pistons, after, I believe it was the 89 Eastern Conference Finals, Jordan started hitting the gym and put on muscle, so the pummeling that he would get from Bill Laimbeer and Rick Mahorn wouldn't take so much of a physical toll on him, and the Bulls fought back with the Pistons until they eventually beat them in 1991. So I get, and even they've said that, like, the Pistons, Isaiah Thomas and John Sally, they said, we had to go through the Boston Celtics to become what we were. And the Bulls had to go through the Pistons to become what they were. And I think that's where the respect comes from the Pistons and Pistons fans, and that he did beat them eventually.
Yeah, you stay on top until somebody beats you. And I think that's kind of what's partly tragic about the Bulls, the ending of the first Bulls three-peat, that, you know,
he's still a dick for you went off three, the dream team.
Yeah, so there's all that. And then, but yeah, I think that's kind of what's kind of legendary about this Bulls team, is like they win three championships and then Jordan retires. And then the Rockets win the next two championships. But then there's always the question of, like, would some of those Rockets teams have beaten those Bulls teams? And I think the answer is yes for at least one of them. But
sidebar, boys.
That's still debatable.
Sidebar but, time.
Yeah.
I'm gonna ask you first, Kaz. It's the 1984 NBA draft.
Oh, Lord. All right, go ahead. Keep going.
It was the first three picks were Hakeem Olajuwon, Sam Bowie, and Michael Jordan. You're the GM, and you've got the first overall pick, and you know Hakeem is there, but you also know MJ is there. Who are you taking?
Jordan. We're only talking about the first three, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really hard to do this question without hindsight, because, like, at the time, like, nobody knew how much of a psycho Michael Jordan was, and I mean, and that's part of what this documentary goes into too.
But I'm also thinking about the team that you know the Knicks had going into the later 90s, right? Does Michael Jordan gel with Patrick Ewing, right? Like, does Michael Jordan gel with you know, anybody else who's on that team? Or is Hakeem Olajuwon a better fit? You get rid of Patrick Ewing, and then do you just have a better overall team? Or do you run a two big man option? Like this is a legitimate question for me right now. I kind of want to pick Hakeem Olajuwon my chances.
And the thing is, nobody trashes the Rockets for making that pick. Part of it is because they got two championships out of that, and part of that is because Hakeem is maybe, at least in my opinion, maybe the most skilled center of all time. He was a good player. Like, the team they trash is the Blazers for taking Sam Bowie, and his career was kind of ended by injuries. So in a way, that wasn't really their fault either. But I mean, so much of the NBA at the time, it's like, it looks so different now, where the big man is kind of an afterthought. But back then, like, so much of the game played through the big man. You had guys like, yeah, through the seven footers, the guys like Kareem and Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain. And, you know, like, you needed those kind of guys, which is why guys like Hakeem Olajuwon and Patrick Ewing and even going all the way through the 90s, and guys like Shaq and David Robinson and, you know, those guys were really important. And there's still some traditional people in basketball that won't let go of that idea of chasing the unicorn big man.
I still love you, Andre. I still love you.
Yeah, guys like Andre Drummond and Dwight Howard and so it's all of that, that mindset came from back then. So back when the game was more structured towards playing through those guys. And
they changed the rules for Michael Jordan because, oh no, he was getting beat up when he took off. Oh no.
One of the really interesting things about Michael Jordan is a lot of his game, like if you look at it, maybe it's a little different if you look at a shot chart, but if you look at his shot selection in general, you would trash any guard coming out of college nowadays for taking those kinds of shots. But what made Michael Jordan so great is that he could hit all those mid-range jumpers that we keep telling people don't take those anymore. He could hit those at such an efficient rate that it kind of breaks analytics, or it breaks conventional modern NBA analytics, because he could just hit those shots at an efficient rate. And when you're going up against a guy who can hit inefficient shots efficiently, then those guys are kind of just unstoppable. And there's a couple players in the NBA that are like that now, but none that I think were at the same level as Jordan was for a lot of those shots. On top of the fact that he was an athletic freak, on top of the fact that he was, a tremendous defensive player, and on top of the fact that he was just a goddamn psycho when it came to competitiveness. So that's, all guys, of that has kind of built the legend.
As much as I'd love to talk about Phil Jackson doing acid in the 70s while he was playing for the Knicks, I know that we could spend a whole podcast on both him and especially Dennis Rodman, but we're going to have to keep it moving.
Yeah. Okay. So the NFL draft happened. I think we were talking about it before, like this is like the first kind of online draft. Everybody's drafting remotely, and we're trying to show video from both ESPN headquarters and trying to conduct interviews without conducting this draft in person. Like, how is this going to go? And it turns out that that part actually went pretty smoothly. And I know some people, myself included, were watching just to try to see if there would be a technical hiccup. If like somebody was going to miss their draft slot because their internet like shat the bed. And that didn't happen. Kudos to the technical staff of all these teams for actually managing to conduct a relatively smooth draft. Some of them needed bigger teams than others to do this. Apparently Lions GM Bob Quinn had to put an IT team in a Winnebago in his driveway in order to make sure everything was working correctly. Other people had some pretty interesting things going on in the background of their respective scenes. Some people chose really weird ways to point their cameras. Overall, like everything went pretty smooth. If there were hiccups, I think ESPN did a pretty good job of like cutting away from it, because they had like 200 some video feeds to choose from. It went really smooth. Like, you wouldn't believe that this was the first time that they've done this. A lot of credit goes to the logistical teams for managing to make this work. A couple of the weird, quirky things about the draft, though, is ESPN somehow managed, for some reason, they decided to include fun fact is the wrong word. On all of their little boards showing like just the interesting stats and bullets about these players. Tragic tales is a good way to put it. Like, they managed for the last one for every single draftee, it seemed like every single draftee, to just include like, oh, this player's father died. This player's mom contracted West Nile virus in 2012, and you know, this player's mom fought drug addiction while they were growing up. Like, just so much weirdly personal tragic shit. Just like it was kind of like tragedy porn for the sake of like showing how much these players have overcome to get here. And it was
adversity is a good, it's the greatest storyline, right? Like yeah, DJM just said it's human interest, right? It's you humanize these people who are going to be millionaires and probably drive a car into your driveway, right? Like you gotta have the human element to them, right? You can't just talk about the millions of dollars they're gonna make when everybody else is sad and stuck in their house. You gotta bring a little, you know, something to it, right? Because everybody's just watching a bunch of people become millionaires, so that's all they're gonna talk about. They're just gonna be like, why do I care? But if you're like, hey, you know, not only is all this tragedy already happening, but look at this tragic life this guy's had. You're like, oh man, really? And then you realize, oh, they're about to become a millionaire. Eh.
It's just they did it so often that it became a meme. So that's like you always got to balance that desire to introduce human interest stuff, and then like if you do it too much, then it almost seems like you're enjoying it. And yeah, like I think there was one meme that got shared between us of like, here's all the Avengers and here's their draft boards, and then like, or you know, all these different superheroes, and like here's Batman, and then you know, last bullet is you know, he watched his parents get killed in front of him, and then like here's Thor, and then like he watched his girlfriend, you know, just get, you know, whatever. Like I haven't seen a whole lot of those movies, but still, like it just became so much of a thing that it was noticed by everybody, and it wasn't just noticed because like we found out about it on Twitter. Like I think everybody kind of came to the like, oh wow, they're talking about this stuff a lot. All right, so overall, things seem to go okay for most teams, but I think one team, at least early on, that might have messed up was the Green Bay Packers. I think Aaron Rodgers, dragged this team to the NFC Championship game last year where they lost to the 49ers, but he needs a lot of help on offense, and he's been kind of trying to do a lot of this himself. And so he needs skill position players around him, wide receivers, running backs, all that. So he was saying before the draft, it would be nice if they could draft a skill player, because the last time they drafted one was in 2005 when they drafted him. And it's been a while.
Guys, that's exactly why I'm totally going against everybody else here. And I'm saying I like the Packers picking Jordan Love. I like this. And not just because I'm a Lions fan who's hoping that this could be the end of the Packers finally. I actually think that drafting a quarterback now, while you still have a veteran starting quarterback, is actually a good idea, Bob Quinn.
I feel like, I mean, there's degrees of this, right? Because there's, there's draft a quarterback early on in the first round. Then that means like, you know, this guy is your franchise guy, and you know you got to build around this guy in the future, and you expect them to start sooner rather than later. We're within a year or two, like maybe start them immediately. And then there's like end of the first round where it's like, okay, maybe this guy might sit for a year or two. And then later than that, then it's kind of okay. Like you don't necessarily need this person to start right away, but But still, the those quarterbacks drafted in the first one or two rounds, they are guys that you eventually expect to start for your team. The Packers traded up to move up from 30 to 26 to draft Jordan Love. And the thing is, like, whether Jordan Love or Aaron Rodgers is going to be the quarterback, there aren't a whole lot of weapons around them. Mm-hmm. When your star player is asking for help around him, I feel like, first of all, you should try to support him on that and get him some help.
And then
next on the list of bad things to do is to draft somebody that isn't that helpful. And then next on the list of things you don't want to do is draft somebody who plays. It's one thing if, like, this is your wide receiver saying this, and then you draft another wide receiver to play on the other side of the field. At least they can both play at the same time. But this is your quarterback, where only one plays at a time, unless somebody gets really creative in the next couple of years. You can only play one quarterback at a time, and Aaron Rodgers is that guy. He's got 104 years, $126 million left on his contract. It's like they went down the list of good things they can do and found what is objectively not a bad idea to be prepared in a couple of years for what may eventually be Rodgers' departure. But he's a guy who's said that he wants to play for a long time. We've seen Tom Brady play long past past when they thought he would be able to play.
Good for him. Yeah. This is the way I look at this situation. Weird.
Like, instead of giving him help, they drafted his replacement.
Yeah.
And that on its own, it just feels bad.
But so there's a number of ways you can take this situation, right? Like, one, they drafted his replacement, which is most likely true. But maybe they drafted his replacement a few years down the line, and maybe they're looking at options of doing everything else in free agency. Maybe there are guys that they have their eyes on that they think that they can move some people around to maybe get some more veteran-style help for him at this moment rather than rookies that they're not so sure about.
Maybe. I don't know their cap situation, so maybe I can't really comment on that. But the thing is, like, rookies are, you know, especially like effective rookies, which is normally what you get from the first round, are some of the most cost effective ways to fill out your team, because their contracts are usually small. And they're set. Like, somebody, you know, when you draft somebody at position 26, you know that you know, this is the small range of dollar values that you can pay this player. You don't have to go through this big prolonged contract negotiation. Worst case scenario, you just pay them the top of that range, which is already pretty low. The point does stand that the last time they did this was with Aaron Rodgers. This was when Brett Favre was still on the team. At the time, Brett Favre was also waffling about retirement. He was going into every offseason, and you didn't know whether he was going to come back. That's not the case with Aaron Rodgers. He just signed a massive extension. So he's got, like I said, 4 years and $126 million left on that contract. He's not retiring anytime soon, even though he is getting older, even though he is the same age as Brett Favre was at the time that Rodgers was drafted. So there are a lot of parallels there. But, you know, maybe the parallel is that Aaron Rodgers is getting screwed in the same way that Brett Favre was. So if you want to read into it that way, then that's it's a little weird when they could have just, you know, yeah, it might be the circle of life, but also they could have just drafted a wide receiver and made another run at it at trying to get to the Super Bowl again next year. So the Eagles also kind of did the same thing, but I feel like the context helps them a little bit on this. They've got Carson Wentz, who a couple years ago played at an MVP level and then got injured. And I feel like the Eagles can be forgiven for doing this more than anybody else, because the Eagles have always, always highly valued their backup quarterbacks, to the point where there are very few years in their history since I've been watching football that they did not have a quarterback controversy.
Yeah.
That's how much they value their backup quarterbacks. Like, I'm actually looking at this list, and you know, when I started watching football, it was Rodney Pete and Randall Cunningham. And, you know, and then that goes into Ty Detmer and Rodney Pete. And then, you know, and then like the years where they had Donovan McNabb, I think were relatively calm until the city turned on him. And then eventually it was Donovan McNabb and Kevin Cobb and Kevin Cobb and Michael Vick. And then it finally paid off during that year Carson Wentz got injured, because Nick Foles, his backup, ended up helping them win a Super Bowl. So when you are a team that won a Super Bowl with your backup quarterback, then I think you're allowed to have the excuse of, I'm going to draft a quarterback in the second round because you know, the backup quarterback position is really valuable for us. Carson Wentz didn't just get injured that year. He got injured the next year, and Nick Foles had to take the reins again in the playoffs. So it's like they've gotten a lot of value out of the backup quarterback position. So them drafting Jalen Hurts in the second round, again, this is still a little bit different than trading up to get a guy in the first round. I think Adam Schefter went on TV and said, well, what happens if Carson Wentz gets COVID? And I think that's a little dramatic, but yeah. Also, what happens if Wentz gets injured? Because he gets injured a lot and has a history of it. So I think, you know, those two situations are a little bit different, even though they seem like they're kind of the same on the surface. But yeah, Jalen Hurts now backup quarterback for the Philadelphia Eagles, and also potentially a starter in a couple of years. Maybe it gives them an option to, maybe this is potentially a quarterback controversy in a couple of years, but they say Carson Wentz is their guy, but also they really value the backup quarterback position. So it's, I think they thought they had their franchise guy, and there's always potentially another franchise guy around the corner. And so, yeah. As far as our teams went, I think your team, Kaz, and my team, and the team that lives in DJM's vicinity, all did relatively well. They all got kind of B grades from the various different sources.
Guys, I don't know what to do with this. I liked the Lions draft. I really, really did. And I don't know what to do with that.
It's in a way. And I mean, because I think a lot of us were also expecting, like, oh, these guys didn't get a chance to scout much. And so they might have to rely on just kind of just traditional evaluation. But I think sometimes general managers can overthink things.
I believe I found the pattern with the Lions draft class for this year. And when I was looking at them and I was looking through, I started noticing that a lot of the players that the Lions drafted had connections with other players on the roster. Excluding their first round pick, number 3 overall, Jeff Okuda. And even he mentioned their 5th round pick, a wide receiver out of Wisconsin, Quentin Cephas. He said that Quentin Cephas was the best wide receiver he went up against in college. So that was one example. Another one was their seventh round pick, who was a friend with their one of their offensive linemen, Frank Ragnow. And I think the best example of this would be their third round pick, Julian Okwara, who is the younger brother of Romeo Okwara, who plays for the Lions. So I think that it looks as though what the Lions organization did, along with whatever kind of scouting they did in spite of the pandemic. Also, the Lions front office coached the Senior Bowl, so they had a leg up in that regard. Oh, is that yeah. they talked to other players. They talked to their players about guys that were coming out to see if they played with them or knew them. And I don't know, it kind of worked out. Like, it's kind of bizarre. Like, here in the Detroit area, pretty much everyone has this kind of, like, whoa, this draft class is actually kind of good. There was nothing really crazy about it. And we kind of collectively don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, and ultimately, we won't know for sure until these guys actually play. And then, and on top of that, like, as we mentioned earlier, regarding people like Ryan Tannehill and Drew Brees, we don't necessarily know how good these guys will be until we see them play for many years and maybe on multiple teams. And so we don't even know whether this Lions coaching staff is still going to be the same coaching staff in a couple of years, especially with the Lions, who have a history of recycling those, you know, of a lot of turnover. So it's tough to give out grades now. It's in a way, it's kind of silly, but one way we can evaluate these picks is based off of value or whether they fit positions of need. And it looks like at least our three teams for the most part have done that. I think, you know, each of our teams has, different goals for the season. For the 49ers, it's get back to the Super Bowl and actually win it this time. So, you know, they're a lot of the moves they made were actually kind of outside the draft because they didn't have a lot of picks coming in. They traded a lot of them away. But I think left tackle Joe Staley was having health problems, and so he needed to retire. The 49ers managed to engineer a trade to get Trent Williams from Washington, who has been holding out for the last couple years. And so he was one of the best left tackles in the game. And so, you know, they managed to fill that position of need on draft day, even though it wasn't through the draft. They traded DeForest Buckner away, one of their linchpin defensive tackles, to the Colts a couple months back, because they knew that they couldn't pay him the kind of contract that he wanted. They got a first round pick back for him. They used one of those. With one of their two first round picks, this year they replaced him, and got one of the best tackles in the draft. And then also got a wide receiver who is at a position of need as well. So that, you know, again, they filled positions of need at all of their different picks. And, so I think that's the best you can ask for a team that is, a Super Bowl contender. You know, for a rebuilding team like the Giants like the Giants, I think it's just, can you accumulate talent? And it looks like they've done that as well.
I mean, we talked about for the majority of the year how they have the talent on offense, and their defense has been somewhat lacking. I still think there's a few things offensively that they could look at, but I also think it's a gelling period, right? So I think they're going to try to give that offense some time to gel together before they look at replacing or moving things around. So it's you move on to the next project, right? So the next project is your defense and filling out your defensive roster. And I kind of tend to agree with what some of these articles said, which is they did good. They got good parts to kind of round out that defense and make it more formidable. But I think they also kind of missed opportunities in certain parts that they filled. I think they filled spots that they already have filled by good talent. I think they could have done with a few more linebackers. They could have done with a few more coverage safeties rather than these guys who are better at, you know, rushing the line and things like that. But overall, I still think they got good parts and pieces to help fill out that defense.
Yeah, the analytics nerd in me always wishes there would be a way that you can go back and look at a previous draft and kind of like simulate what would have happened had these guys just done the conventional wisdom of like, this is the guy everybody says you should take in the mock draft. So just take that guy and don't overthink it. And I feel like a lot of our teams chose not to overthink it. Don't like, maybe you can take a big risk on a guy because you think you have more information about them, because you think you're smarter than every other scout out there. Because
speaking of, you know, going against conventional wisdom, guys, and thinking you're smarter than every other scout, Kaz, how are you feeling about what the Giants did in the draft?
Wait, did you not hear my whole spiel?
I felt like you have said a little bit, but not like a ton.
Well, I mean, like I said, I think overall, it's the next thing you had to do, right? They worked on the offense the last few years. They have the parts and pieces there, so I think it's you go on to doing the defense. And I think overall, you never really know until you see people play, is kind of the big thing. It seems good. I would love the Giants to have a formidable defense coming into what I think is going to be a year of very, very, very high-paced offenses, especially knowing that the Baltimore Ravens are going to be there, especially knowing teams like Kansas City are going to be there. And I think people are going to try to start adapting to those kind of plays. So I think you really have to come into the next 2, 3, 4 years of football with a strong defense, because that's what's going to win you games. I'm not super sure on all the parts of their offense, but I'm pretty sure they drafted right on the defensive side this year.
Okay. All right.
I don't trust Daniel Jones. That's what I'm saying.
Well, they drafted a left tackle, didn't they?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So if they trust Daniel Jones, they should at least protect Daniel Jones. So that's going to help. This is going to be the first year without Eli Manning. So they got some cap room to play with, I think. But also it's going to be weird to not see him there on the sidelines, for the first time in a long time. Hashtag Danny Dimes. So our final football story and our final story of the day is an update on Tom Brady in Tampa Bay.
Yeah. Whew. This has been a weird roller coaster that I did not expect or want.
Yeah, he's gone full Florida man, basically. First story. I mean, yeah, maybe it is what we needed, though. First news coming from Tom Brady out of Tampa was him getting kicked out of a public park for violating stay-at-home orders. It's always like it's always interesting to think about, like, having to do your job and then realizing that, like, the person you're trying to kick out of the park is Tom Brady, the new guy in town, but also just at least nationally famous athlete. That's just the first part. The second part was him trying to meet with the assistant coach Brian Leftwich in Brian Leftwich's house. this time he actually was trying to follow COVID guidelines. So I think Leftwich had meant to leave something for him to come pick up inside his house. And so Tom Brady went into what he thought was Byron Leftwich's house, but turned out it was somebody else's house. And
ladies and gentlemen, this is why you leave your goddamn doors locked. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you are Tom Brady. Don't walk in my goddamn house.
Yeah, so the
also I'm gonna make sure you can't walk in my house by leaving my goddamn doors locked. Stop leaving your doors unlocked, people. Too many of you motherfuckers do this. I've learned this.
I agree with you, but in this case, that's why I was specifically looking for this tidbit, but the person was actually selling his house. So he had like a legit reason for leaving the door unlocked. I think this was like an open house situation. And
what are you doing an open house for during goddamn coronavirus?
Or I don't know if it was an open house, but it was something like he had a legitimate reason related moved, to the fact Kaz. That he
moved there.
Yeah.
Maybe he's looking around.
No, the guy who's selling the house.
Yeah, the guy who's selling the house, but also
an open house during a widespread pandemic.
I might have gotten that fact wrong, but I know he had a legitimate reason for leaving the front door unlocked.
All right.
But so because he did that,
don't
he walked
this man.
He walked in there and then found a trespasser in his room and that holding two duffel bags, and that trespasser happened to be Tom Brady. I think he was so shocked that he didn't actually realize it. And then afterwards ran after Brady as Brady was leaving after he apologized and actually chased him down and tried to get a picture with him, which I think that's at that point, like once you kick the guy out of your house, you can't chase him down later and try to get a picture with him. That's just a little weird. But on top of Tom Brady going full Florida man, we also have current reigning WWE 24/7 champion Rob Gronkowski, who is coming out of retirement to play tight end for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers to catch passes from his old friend Tom Brady. And so that going to make a high-powered Tampa Bay offense even more high-powered. This team is now a championship contender.
And now Brunk gets to live in an actual party state, like rather than just.
Well, I think he was doing that before because he was working for the WWE and their performance center is down there. So
yeah.
So
did you guys see the video of Tom summoning Gronk?
I think I saw that where he like pulled out the shell and then like blew into it, and then Gronk just came running out of the woods.
Yes, that was good.
Maybe
content.
Maybe that's what they were taping in the park when Brady got kicked out. So if the whole point of him getting kicked out was for content and not for just regular practice, then it was worth it. The Patriots received a fourth round pick in return for a seventh round pick and the rights to Rob Gronkowski. So they got something out of this too, out of what was effectively a retired player. So good for everybody involved. And I guess that'll be fun at the very least to see Rob Gronkowski back in the NFL.
Yeah.
Was it 1 or 2 years retired? It wasn't long.
I want to say it might be 3.
I don't buy into him as much as like a TV personality. I don't think his shtick as a bro that is partying is all that entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
So him back out on the football field is all right.
Yeah, 2 years or 1 full year, I guess.
Also, I totally buy into the idea that the first person to tackle him and stay on him for 3 seconds is the new WWE 24/7 champion. So,
JVZ, I was actually going to ask you about that. I was just going to ask you about that. What is the over-under on this becoming a crossover between the WWE and the NFL.
I think they have to somehow do it. Like, I feel like the No Fun League is not going to let something like this happen, but there's already referees on the field. There's a bunch of people out there that can just do the three count.
Follow-up question, JVZ. Follow-up question. What if it's Brady that takes the title?
I feel like that would be easier to pull off because you could just do that goofing off in a preseason game and nobody's going to criticize you for not taking the game seriously at that point. It'll just be a fun thing, and then it'll be fun headlines for everybody for like a week, and then at some point they'll keep the bit going, and then it'll get old. And then they'll somehow find a way to actually transition this title back into the WWE. And then 10 years from now, we'll talk about, hey, remember the time that the WWE 24/7 championship changed hands in the middle of an NFL preseason game. It'll be a nice fun thing. Hopefully they don't milk it too much, but it'll be fun for a little bit. Speaking of fun for a little bit, thank you guys for listening to our show. Head on over to sportsoddsandends.com for show notes and links to all the previous episodes. Patreon.com/sportsoddsandends if you wanted to support the show financially. If you want to support the show verbally, you can hit us up on Twitter. I'm at JVZ, Kaz is at King Kaz, DJM is at Call Me DJM. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.